welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
All right, welcome back. And it is now or never. So what we want to do is dive into the presidential election episode. But let me just say this, that there is efforts right now in Montana, in Wyoming, in South Dakota, in Missouri, and in Georgia, and in Virginia, where efforts are being made to try to get organized, to try to unite people. If you are interested, if you're living in any of those states and you're interested in actually getting involved in the petitions, in getting involved in holding public servants accountable, I want to make sure you understand this, that the reason why our government is the way it is because we, the people, had completely neglected this concept of holding our government accountable. We may have held them accountable to, you know, certain things, but if you go through, you know, the annals of this nation, you will find that there was really no accountability to holding them accountable to their oath of office and to the Constitution. When I look at the petitions and when I look at all of the efforts, 9 times out of 10, it's always been over, you know, something that people don't like. I mean, we've really lost sight of what the enumerated roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties are, and in holding them accountable. So if we actually all of a sudden shift, and it doesn't take much, folks, it just takes a few people to start getting involved. And before you know it, other people are going to have the epiphany. It just takes a little bit of noise. Just remember, that little wheel, that little teeny wheel on the cart that starts squeaking, that gets the oil. It always starts with a little bit of a squeak, and you kind of notice that. And then over time, as it grows, as your organization grows, you're going to get the oil. You will get the oil. And as a matter of fact, the oil is not just actually oiling, but the oil process is the changing out of the unconstitutional and replacing. It's kind of like cleansing that wheel structure. You know, you're not removing the wheel. The wheel, the seat is legitimate. It's the person filling the seat that is not doing what they're supposed to be doing in accordance with their oath. They've been sucked into these bonds. They've been sucked into all of these things that have nothing to do with fulfilling their oath and supporting the Constitution. So it kind of goes down this vein or this, you know, this concept, folks, that all we really need to do is demand. So stop asking for what they can do for you. Can you get us some jobs? Can you bring us some money? Believe me, folks, as we restructure the United States, there's going to be all sorts of great opportunities from the changes that we're going to see. We're actually going to see a government that will lead the world in liberty, a government that will secure liberty and ensure liberty because of the Constitution. So this is why we're going through the ratification debates, to provide all of the insights that it provides and the definitions and clarifications that these men provided in helping people understand what this Constitution really means. It's not what it just says. 9 times out of 10, as a matter of fact, I've ran into people that have been teaching Constitution classes that based it on reading the Constitution, in other words, what it said. And you cannot do that. I've seen many people pervert. I remember a gentleman out of Oregon that was teaching constitutional classes, was offering them. And, you know, he's growing and he's helping people understand his paradigm of what he believes that means. In other words, when he reads these concepts in the Constitution, he doesn't understand the concept of a standing army. The only way you understand the concept of a standing army, because most people put that in context to the military. The standing army had everything to do with enforcing domestic laws or enforcing things upon the people. In other words, creating tyrannical laws and enforcing them. You know, I'm having just for your edification, I've been kind of breezing through and spending a lot of time on The Wealth of Nations and what Adam Smith basically placed in that. And one of the reasons why is I'm really searching for it. I'm finding some really good citations, but there's one particular citation that I think is important because it's the citation that talks about taxation. I'm going down a quick rat hole, so I want to be as quick as I possibly can. There's way too many people that believe taxation is our problem. Our problem has nothing to do with taxation. It has everything to do with spending, because taxation is only to cover the cost of legitimate government. And so if they're spending on things that they have no legitimate use for, no legitimate call to spend that money, then what they're doing is they're defrauding the American people. And in so doing, they're defrauding them even further by taking on debt. When you are spending more money than you're able to tax the people on things that you have no authority to do, we are in the midst of a constitutional crisis. We are heading towards a meltdown that is actually designed to destroy our constitutional framework and actually submit us to the world. And I am here to tell you that when Washington told us that there were enemies to liberty throughout the world, he means that. But he didn't mean that the people of the world. It is these nefarious leaders, the affluent, the global bankers, the globalists. They didn't have that term back then. But anyway, I digress. What we want to do is we want to get into the presidential, or I should say my special presidential election episodes, because this is really focused on the presidential election. Now, again, like I said on Friday, there are a lot of things that are really playing out, and they're not going to go anywhere. As a matter of fact, there's going to be speculation for the next couple of months. And so I need to get through in the next however many episodes I need to do. But I need to really thoroughly go through this reframing. And so we started off with the, you know, the definitizing process, getting the states to do that, actually having the Congress and the court have both the legislative and the judiciary branch, as well as the executive. The president actually has the authority to say that is not constitutional. That is not within the framework, because if he can veto laws, he can come along and say, if we are executing laws and he's responsible for executing the laws of the union, he can easily say these things we're not executing. So he can easily put a kibosh on the annotated Constitution and many of the other bureaucracies and so forth. But we've kind of covered all that in the first episode. And in the second episode, we got into talking about, you know, the states and tying down the standards of how they're to be admitted into the union. So we were at the process of what they were doing in admitting states into the union. And one of the things I really emphasize is a high fluency in English. All new states coming into the union, before they can be admitted into the union, it's my recommendation, or I believe that it's only logical to ensure that more than a majority of the people in that state, when you're looking at a few million people, you cannot think that it's okay to have millions of people illiterate, or I should say, can't even speak the language. it's not fair to them. And as a matter of fact, this is the whole point of the, I don't want to call it cleansing. It's not about purging a culture or anything like that, but it is integrating them to be as the most optimum that they can be within the union, so that they can actually conduct business, so that they can actually do and make the best decisions because they're informed and they understand the language. So language is very important. And so I believe at a minimum, there should be 75% fluency in English amongst the people of a new state coming in. Another thing is this 100% adoption of precinct and county structures for both the political purpose. Now, see, people talk about politics, and I'm just talking about the political purpose of organizing people, not for the party, but for the purpose of getting representation. It's all about, in a Republican form of government, we need to have representation, and that representation, all the way down to the smallest sub-element, is a precinct, because that's how we vote. And so that's how we work in choosing who our representatives are at the smallest element. And it kind of like creates, I'll just say, you know, the precinct is like the atom. And as these atoms form enough to create a district and then multiple districts, then creates a county. You know, you can kind of see how the building blocks kind of, you know, come together, these Lego pieces, if you want to call it that. But we also have to make sure that the county possesses the full form of government. In other words, meaning a legislative, an executive, and a judiciary. And so in so doing, this will actually force the county to start shifting from, because now you're going to have an executive, and now you're going to have a legislative. The question is, the legislative should probably have, I'm not an advocate of making something more. So if you have a very small population county in the heartland of America, where you're in the numbers of, you know, let's just say, you know, 15,000 or less, or 20,000 or 30,000 or less, then I think three commissioners would be plenty, and then having an executive and, or, you know, call the, if you want to call him a count, I think governor works because he's the governor of the county. And this is not necessarily an autonomous state. And what I mean by that is it does not have the full functions and capabilities and resources that a state would have. And what that means is that they have no representation at the federal level, so they can't influence that, but they will influence the state. So because they're underneath the sovereignty, but this is the principle of where all political power would flow to, so that your county commissioners would determine what type of support and services they would need and would want from the state government. And we want to make sure that we're looking in general sense. We do not want, and what we have to do is, as we start dismantling, because just remember the Department of Health and Human Services, government regulations, and all of the government's involvement in healthcare, that'll go away. Who takes this on? It'll go back to the entities that possessed it prior to government's involvement in the 40s. That's right. So when we look at how these health institutions really started moving forward, the federal government was not involved prior to the 40s. So how was it being done? Now, it was being done in a very independent and lacking. So the question is, should there be standards? Should there be practices? If there should be, then at what level should it be? It should never, ever be at the federal level. So I just want to make sure that if we really want the states to create standards, if we really want the states to kind of have this concept of a central disease control, then you need to actually have the states kind of pull together in a committee or Congress, like a health Congress, a health commission, and let them separately function. Now, just remember that all taxation has been delegated to the federal government, and that the states would then dictate to the federal government that they would fund this new domestic committee. I'm telling you, folks, this would be far cheaper than allowing the federal government, because what ends up happening when you have the opportunity to spend other people's money is you actually will, when you go into lunch and somebody's saying, I'm buying, don't worry about it, we're paying for it. Next thing you know, everybody's ordering, you know, steak and lobster and champagne and caviar. And Milton Friedman gives a really good example of the different ways of spending somebody's money and spending your own money and the difference of how you spend your money than you would allow somebody else to spend your money for you. And the federal government is the most removed, and they are the, you know, the most lavish. They will spend, you know, without, you know, without any consideration of the real cost. So moving this away from the federal government and having the federal government only use taxation to fund it, that would be something that would be apportioned back out to the states if we want to have that. I'm honestly telling you, folks, there are logical reasons why we want to have standards. There's logical reasons why we want the free market to be involved in doing this. But more importantly, we want the institutions to actually do better and get back involved in this, not for profit purposes, but for nonprofit. Because if you really think about it, that's exactly what that's what these institutions do. They understand and they properly compensate. I mean, doctors have always been, you know, very well educated people, and they've always been very well compensated. I mean, it's not very often where you'd see in the old days where a doctor wasn't well off, even in the old days. It's just that they weren't, you know, that well off above so many other people. I mean, they contributed and they went into this, I'll say, career on more of a noble and more of a compassionate drive than it was the desire to get rich. And it was a mechanism of just being able to, because insurances, there's a lot of things that have perverted our medical system. But let me keep going here, because bottom line, as we start structuring our government down to the county level, to the state and so forth, we're going to realize that we're going to have an opportunity to say really what our government wants, because we now look at government being able to do everything. And we understand that that is not the best practice, that we need to move as much of this stuff back out, that there's only certain things that we want to make sure the government is doing. And so we got to look at what government does well, you know, and one of the things government does really well is killing people. They fight wars. Government is the best when it comes to killing people. And so we want to make sure that, you know, we don't give this government the ability to kill us in all sorts of ways, from managing climate control by spraying us, you know, constantly with these chemtrails, or doing all of the other things that they're doing and how they want to control us. See, this is, we're at the opposite end of the spectrum of massive tyranny and massive warfare tactics against the people in the states. So we have to peel all that back and say, okay, what should they have? And the federal government, I think, is within the proper parameters for back in 1700s to today, that we need to actually start thinking outside the box. And that's why I really believe that we need to have other-centric commissions and those types of things to help create standards. But it's not. It's not proper, nor is it appropriate to take from those who have and give to those who have not. I believe that it's enlightenment that allows those who have to provide the necessary education and assistance to those who have not, so that they remember this concept of If you give a man a fish, you fed him for a day. If you teach the man to fish, or woman, then you have fed them for their lives. And so the whole point is, and when we look at how maniacal our government has been, like when Clinton took us into Somalia and basically started feeding them. And so what did that do? It subjugated them. It's this massive manipulation to say, we will feed you and you'll have to basically do our bidding. And that's not right. What we should have been doing, we should have been basically saying, how can you sustain yourself? You've got all of these people here living in this country, incapable of supporting yourself with the resources and the way you've been governing. Is there a way out so that, you know, Somalia can thrive? Is there a way it can actually do something that will allow them to thrive as a nation? Now, you don't have to have a lot of farmland. Look at Singapore. Singapore became a thriving nation because it got into business, finance, and technology and those types of things. Well, you can do the same thing in Somalia. There are certain things that might lend to the geographics. There's other things that might not. But one of the things is that they have to be the controllers of their destiny. And they have to be, their goal should be self-sufficiency. And the problem is that they've had governments that have governed them, or governors governing them, that have never put the liberty of the people first. And that has a lot to do with their cultural, superstitions, or their biases, both religious and so forth. So when we really start looking at how we need to form government in this nation, we need to actually structure, and this is why I'm going down this path, and I'm basically introducing this concept that your county needs to have, and should possibly have, if it is large enough, if it can accommodate, it should have a bicameral legislative body. When I look at King County, when I look at a city that is so massive, the county government, for that many people, should have a bicameral legislative body, so that you have these districts, large areas of large precincts that, you know, have so many people that they actually, you know, choose the people in the district, choose their representative, and the district leader or leaders choose who they want to represent the district in the state, in the county senate. By doing that, you now have these two different checks and balances, from the wants and desires of the people to the needs of governing and the interests of that district area. If it's got agriculture, whatever, you know, vestiges it still may have. I mean, when you look at King County, it's not all brick and mortar and concrete. King County actually does have some farms in it still. It does have, you know, the other things, you know, that aren't necessarily all brick and mortar and concrete and asphalt. So you have to be able to make sure that those districts that have those types of resources, that those types of things are protected. Now, this goes back to this concept of actually maintaining a strategic plan so that the state can ensure and protect. When we look at how things panned out in the western states and even in the eastern states, the development and progress superseded the needs of the people. In other words, we started shifting our agricultural support, our agricultural areas that, you know, grew our food to provide, because everywhere we could provide, and we took our most precious land. I can tell you, throughout the United States, in most of the states like Washington, the precious agricultural area, which was the valley in between Seattle and Olympia, that valley area, that is some of the most richest fertile soil. And they were building there and filling up that area with concrete, asphalt, brick and mortar, and so forth, basically covering their best resource of agriculture. Anyway, we'll dive back into the strategic concepts of this when we come back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, folks, so we have to realize that we sometimes need to put discipline in how we govern and how we grow. And so, you know, the last thing you want to do is make decisions. And 9 times out of 10, people don't make decisions based on future strategic interests. They only care about what's now and what we need. And boy, having this building here closer would be better. And so planners and so forth, they tend to, you know, not think about, you know, the cost or the ramifications of actually losing, you know, this precious land that provides very specific and is capable of doing some very specific heavy lifting for us, like feeding us or, you know, helping our, you know, like the timber in our forest. We want to make sure, because there are, you know, when you look, as a matter of fact, having traveled around a lot and flying a lot, you can kind of see where the natural tree lines are. And you can say, okay, there's a forest area right there that is natural. It's not like, you know, the people planted these, you know, plantations of firs and cedars and oaks and so forth. I mean, some of the hardwood has been planted to grow for harvesting and that type of stuff. But as we fly, we can literally see that most of the natural resources were not planned. They were just there. And those natural resources should actually, you know, be quantified into how they can help us in our growth and in our needs. It's the same thing with energy and everything else. So you want to make sure that you're empowering the folks at the local level as well as the state level to ensure that those needs are being met. Remember, one of the things that has to go away is the CCC, the commodity corporate commercial. It's basically the grain silage. It's the national resource for food storage and so forth. That actually has to all be reallocated back to the state. I'm telling you, there's not enough in the security, or I should say the federal grain reserves, then the federal food reserves, there is not enough. As a matter of fact, it is designed, and it was really designed, to only feed the army and or the military in that type of case where we would need to deploy the military to either seize control or what have you. And as a matter of fact, I learned this from I had an uncle that was a general in the army, and he basically had kind of talked about how they had already mapped out and they realized that they would not be able to have enough food. Why? Because if you look at rice, if you look at corn, you look at grain is a raw product. and we don't eat the raw product. In other words, we actually have that product, you know, milled and then put into cornbread or put into bread or what have you. And so the military doesn't have the productive facilities to be able to accommodate that. And so when they need food and they know that they need to have food immediately, they realized that that strategic resource isn't as important anymore. That at that point in time, we're talking about 70s and the 80s, when the military already started planning on keeping track of, you know, the different food supply nuts or the survivalists and those types of things, people that were buying and tracking. And this is a direct violation. What I'm telling you is the fact that they have some kind of database of people who are likely to have large food sources, because when the army needs it, or when they feel that, you know, it's time to seize it, they will. And that might there, folks, should be a wake-up call. You know, is it good to have your food reserves so that, you know, they can be taken from you? I'm telling you, we're at a point where it really doesn't matter. You know, anybody that thinks you can just, you know, resign to actually living, you know, and isolating yourself, you're fooling yourself. Because if you've actually taken care of yourself, then there's probably a good chance that there may be some understanding of you having possibly a lot of food or having the resources that they could come in and take and feed a whole company or what have you. Bottom line, we have to understand that the best investment that you can be making is your time in actually getting government back into the framework of the Constitution and taking away their strategic planning of how they can maintain their tyranny and secure their position in tyranny over us. Because that's what they're planning. You know, there's no institution that plans on their demise. Every institution plans on how they can sustain themselves. And believe you me, it is not in your interest for them to sustain themselves. It is at your cost. It is at our demise. So anyway, let me get back into it, because this is all about the presidential positions, right? So... And this is strictly, I'm actually still in this concept of these nations that are coming in, or states being admitted into the Union. And so we talked about making sure that they get set up, but this also reflects on what we need to be doing as well with our own counties. But they need to actually set up their county representation, you know, or I should say their county government in the similar full form of our Republican form of government, executive, legislative, judiciary. The next thing that the county or the state needs to do is they need to have a 100% adoption of the currency. And when I say currency, the metal coins currency. That whatever they have, if they got paper, whatever their currency is, it will slowly be adopted and phased out. That'll be one thing that they will have integrated into them first, moving and taking away their 10 pesos, because there's lots of nations that have pesos, and taking away, you know, their what they were using as a currency. And if it's gold or silver, it'll be minted back into our currency, so it'll be based on our standards. Another thing is a full adoption of common law and 100% tolerance for Christian values. In other words, we cannot allow, and when I say Christian values, I should mean liberty-valued religion, because bottom line, we want to make sure that, you know, religions that embrace liberty, then those religions need to have full tolerance. Any religion that basically plays this, you have to be one of us, and compulsion and those types of things, whether that be communism, Mohammedanism, Islam, or whatever it is, Satanism, it doesn't matter. Those religions are non-compliant, and those religions must be eradicated. Or those people, you know, have to choose where they're going to go. When I say eradicated, the practice, the open practice and the open dialogue, apostolizing, any of that just has no place in America. It's about discipline, folks. And so we actually need to really consider, you know, instead of killing these people or oppressing them, if there's an Islamic motherland they want to go to, we will, you know, facilitate their transfer outside of this nation back into a land where they can be a part of an Islamic government or a theocracy or a communist theocracy or whatever that religion is. But we cannot allow the enemy that wants compulsion and will do everything they can, because they're actually a natural enemy to liberty. It's okay. We don't have to, you know, they don't have to be here, but we don't have to be enemies either. They can, you know, they can live in complete harmony outside our borders. But when they're inside our borders, they will start to demand that they will have equal rights. And so this kind of goes down this path of citizenship and everything else, because we really need to start looking at taking away citizenship from those who do not have, I'll just say, a compatible paradigm to liberty. In other words, you can't let somebody, you know, with this concept of freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and free. Okay, so you can express those things, but you shouldn't be able to vote, and you shouldn't be able to participate as a citizen. And if you get to a point where it goes beyond expression, and you actually start planning and trying to actually cause an insurrection, because that's really what these are. These religions spawn insurrections. These paradigms spawn insurrections. And the framers, you know, were a little bit too tolerant in allowing the enemy within. Folks, I've said this before, in our judiciary system, in the very first 50 years, if you were not Christian, and you could not have, you know, accountability to a power greater, you know, to you, such as God, then you were an infidel and you had no business being in court. You couldn't take a case to court. We've got evidence of this. Democracy in America reveals this. Joseph Story reveals this. And even Thomas Jefferson suffered from this. Now, we want to make sure, because I think there's a way to do this without actually taking somebody because they're not involved in a religion per se, like Thomas Jefferson. But we need to make sure that individuals who embrace those concepts, you know, I've seen plenty of movies and I've seen plenty of our scenarios, read books and so forth. And these are all altruistic types of books where society becomes, you know, such a where everybody becomes a participant in the policing. It's, and as far as I'm concerned, it's not a policing. It is making sure that mutual respect and mutual dignity is there. Again, it's only when people want to spawn ideas of demanding that they have their rights and that they have these fundamental things that will actually take away our liberty. When they want, you know, a welfare, when they want things, you know, they want their health care, they want government to do things when government does not have that responsibility. It's one thing to sit down and talk about introducing the concept of maybe government taking over healthcare and amending the Constitution to do that. But it's another thing to say you need to implement it. because what you're basically doing is you're demanding violations. You're actually involved in insurrecting against the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't allow that to happen like that. And so when you want to choose those types of courses, then you need to actually suffer the consequences by losing your citizenship, period. I don't see any other way of doing this. Most people think that this thing called citizenship, see, it's really, really hard for a person to actually lose their natural DNA and their membership in God's kingdom. Not that they can't do that, but we understand that you always have a choice. And with God and with, you know, his plan, we actually have this ability to always choose to do the right thing. Now, you can sin and there are consequences with that, but that's up to God. But when it comes to citizenship, we have to have a very thin line as to whether you're going to be a citizen or not. We're not taking away your God-given rights, but you no longer have any rights under this Constitution and under this government when you violate those things. So as a matter of fact, I honestly see when you actually start committing crimes against people, you steal from them. You know, in those days, that was a capital offense. Stealing it wasn't just horse theft. And so they looked at that as a tantamount, an ultimate capital sin. Well, I honestly believe that we have to include, we've become way too soft and way too tolerant. We're at a point now where we don't want to punish people for crimes. We want to punish them. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing people actually being punished because their ideology of liberty is no longer acceptable to those of subjugation. This is why we're seeing, you know, criminals being left out, but people that are, you know, demanding compliance of the Constitution are being arrested and they're being incarcerated and they're going to jail and they're being kept in jail because they're actually espousing that these people are a greater threat. They're only a greater threat to their plan of globalism. We have to really understand this. This is exactly what's happening, that they have been emboldened and they have grown so much. And only because we've actually been able to, you know, knock a few rocks around to pull them off of the earth and see the vermin and the parasites that are existing underneath these rocks, such as Epstein, such as all of these, you know, abominations that we're seeing and that they're covering up, human trafficking, all of this crap that our government is protecting. And anybody that gets, you know, indicted, anybody that goes to jail, they're letting them go. Ah, but those people who want to actually demand the rule of law and compliance of the rule of law, they're the threat. This is how evil this has gotten. And we actually have to stand up, and this is why we demand that when states come into this union, they need to be better than us. We need to have a much higher bar of demanding, again, 100% adoption of common law and 100% tolerance towards all faiths and ideologies of liberty. 100%. And we have to actually have a very low threshold, not a zero tolerance. I was going to say zero, but a very low threshold of tolerance towards subjugative ideologies. In other words, those who want to subjugate, those who want to compel, those who believe that they're better than others and that, you know, a caste system, what have you. That can't happen. Individual liberty and individual sovereignty. Remember, India has a caste system. Now, it's the caste system, I don't believe, is innate or is a part of, you know, Hindu and so forth. But, you know, I'm kind of ignorant on those things. Bottom line, we have to have a very low threshold in allowing those types of paradigms to even exist. It's not that we want to censor. It's just that we say, you know what, you want to have that? That's fine, but you're not a citizen. You can't vote, and you can't participate in this great experiment called the American way. Anyway, the last thing that I want to cover for the admittance of states into the union is the full integration of the militia system. And what I'm talking about, because now I need to go into the next tier or the next real position regarding national defense, because national defense is a huge umbrella. I mean, huge. And so we right now have this thing called basically the military industrial complex. And we actually have designed within the Constitution a military industrial, but it's not really industrial. It's a military fundamental structure of national security. And we need to shift our paradigms and take away our desires of fighting wars and actually understand the importance of executing the laws constitutional. Or I should say, executing the laws of the union. And if they're of the union, they're also of the states and they're also of the counties. Because when it comes to specific rights, privileges, immunities, those types of things, then we have to make sure that the people are not losing their rights, they're not losing their privileges, they're not losing their immunities through local laws. Remember, the federal government really wasn't the culprit in subjugating and or becoming tyrannical, you know, throughout the ages of the United States. Who were the bad actors? It was usually the states and or those people in state and local government. And so we're going to basically kind of take the top off of this, and this all kind of falls underneath the reconfiguration of the Department of Defense to align with the Constitution. So the first thing that we have to do is we have to sunset. We have to basically have a plan of standing down and transitioning the departments of space, the departments of the Army, the Department of the Air Force, and the Coast Guard under the Department of Transportation, and move all forces that serve a strategic nature. In other words, actively running, you know, our national defense over the air and over the land. Because remember, that was the Navy's role, was to protect us from external threats. Right? And so, you know, whether that threat is coming across water or whether it's coming through the air, that is the United States Navy's responsibility. And if it's coming from space, that is the Navy's responsibility. And so all things that are strategic nature, you know, whether when we look at, you know, force occupation, Germany, Italy, Japan, all around the world, we have force occupations because we fought a war there. All of that really needs to be realigned, and we need to pull that out. But all of those forces that are there currently need to be realigned underneath the Navy and the Marine Corps as they phase these things out. All of the bases need to be transitioned back to. Now, when I say bases, I mean occupying force bases. We actually have agreements for strategic forces like our Navy ships and what will be our naval aircraft, whether that be for tankers, whether that be for air intercepts or what have you. We do have this military involvement that we have strategic interests. And actually, the mission of these interests should actually be realigned so that the existing state takes these over. But we need to be emissaries for those existing states, the people of those states, to basically say, you know, we're transitioning out of here. And in so doing, we would basically say, you're all on your own. And if you want to have a life of liberty, if you want to invoke, because I think the parting gesture should be ensuring that these people really don't want to become a part of the states of the United States. They would only become a state in the United States. Because if they want to, and 9 times out of 10, people don't want to necessarily do that because for whatever reason, for whatever biases they have, they think that they're better off. And what ends up happening is all of a sudden a despot comes in and they realize that they're in a government that can actually flop back and forth between anarchy and tyranny, anarchy and tyranny. We maybe have, you know, but the only reason that most of the nations in this world have any level footing for the people is because of the United States. And this will actually be proven as we stop stabilizing all these parts of Europe. We had no business, Clinton had no business of going into Bosnia and Herzegovina and Kosovo and so forth. And so the whole point is that we need to actually, you know, let all of these nations start carrying their load. That our real interest, our national interest, is one for defense purposes, and two, to ensure the free flow of our commerce. Therefore, we're not obligated to actually defend their commerce. So what'll end up happening is there'll be this league of pirates that will actually start picking on nations that aren't paying their fair share of how much they, you know, commute across the Pacific, the Atlantic, the waters, the world waters. Because once you're in the world waterway, you're, you know, and you're moving commerce, you have a responsibility to support your commerce. This is one of the things that was proven in the beginning of this nation, is that we had to secure and support our flow of commerce. If not, then we would actually be tossed to and fro. So we have this responsibility of doing this. And so the whole point of integrating the Coast Guard would actually be a part of, you know, helping other nations by, you know, integrating their own Coast Guard to ensuring that, you know, there's no piracy close by, because there are countries that actually have, I'll just say, they're a breeding ground, they're a petri dish to allow these types of things to occur. And some of the places that would actually require, you know, a really good military presence would be the Persian Gulf, maybe the Mediterranean, you know, these small waterways where, you know, your commerce actually becomes kind of threatened. And so if either the world starts putting navies up there, or they start funding our costs and sharing based on how much commerce goes through, that can all be figured out. But the apportionment or the funding should actually be representative of those people who are participating in that, in securing the flow of commerce. This is really simple. This is not difficult. And it's not to be like, you know, gang protection. We're not to harass. We're strictly saying, if you want our protection, you can pay for it. If you don't want our protection, then you're on your own. And it's that simple. So when we come back next Monday, we'll be covering a lot more of the restructuring and the reconfiguration of the Department of Defense and kind of our global strategies. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.